I'm Peter O'Dowd, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support your NPR station at donate.npr.org/now. Here and Now helps you make sense of the world right now, the impact of the pandemic on every aspect of our lives, the transition to the Biden administration, and how that will change Washington and America and your hometown, and all the stories from around the country, the local and regional news that resonates everywhere. So make a donation today, and that investment will come right back to you. It is more important than ever. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now let's get to the news.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now. This week, there is hope as people across the country begin to get the coronavirus vaccine. At the same time, the virus continues to spread.
In Los Angeles County, the tally of positive cases is staggering. More than 500,000 people have tested positive. And as of today, there are less than 100 open ICU beds in a county made up of 10 million people. Let's bring in Dr. Christina Galli, L.A. County Director of the Department of Health Services. Doctor, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, so I mentioned the number of ICU beds are dwindling in LA County hospitals, but it's also emergency rooms that are backed up too. What does this surge mean for LA hospitals? Have you been able to go in and see what's happening?
Yes, we're at really a very dangerous point in this pandemic, and it's important for people to realize that it's dangerous not just for the patients who have COVID, but at this point, given how full the hospitals are, it's dangerous for patients who don't have COVID as well. As you said, the hospitals are getting full, the emergency departments are crowded, ambulances are having trouble often offloading patients in a timely manner. And the number of available beds in the hospitals is filling up. And this puts tremendous strain on the healthcare system and complicates the care that is provided to anyone who needs hospital-level services.
It sounds chaotic and scary. What are some of the ways hospitals are addressing this surge? We're reading that some are treating critically ill patients in emergency rooms. What else are they doing?
So, as you mentioned, many of them have expanded the types of space that they're using to care for ICU patients. They'll be using their emergency departments or their operating rooms or their recovery room areas to care for inpatients, including ICU patients. They're certainly doing everything they can to discharge patients when they can be safely discharged. And I'm glad to say that sometimes there's some new ways that we can do this for COVID patients. Many times COVID patients now can be cared for at home with home oxygen, and that allows them not to have to occupy an inpatient bed. And that's been a very safe way to be able to expand the amount of care that's given to individuals. Obviously, hospitals are doing everything they can to bring in additional staff and open up new beds. The problem with that is that, as you know, across the country, everyone is experiencing a surge. So there's really intense competition for the limited number of staff that have the training needed to be able to care for patients, especially that ICU level of training.
What are health officials telling people who would normally go to the ER or the hospital for other reasons?
At this point, if people do have an emergency, a medical emergency, surgical emergency, psychiatric emergency, we want them to go to the emergency room or dial 911. We don't want there to be excess deaths at home because people were afraid of seeking emergency level care. That said, we all know that there are oftentimes a lot of people that use emergency departments and use the 911 system when they aren't truly having an emergency. And that's what we would like to have avoided at this point. So there's other ways to be able to seek care if you're not having an emergency. You can certainly always call your physician office or your provider office. Many times, providers and health plans have nurse advice lines that can be wonderful resources for people when they need some advice about what to do with the symptoms that they're experiencing. There's a number of urgent cares that are out there, and urgent cares aren't in the same emergency medical services system that emergency departments are in. So urgent cares are a great place to go to get care.
Every day, we're reporting these astounding numbers of cases and deaths, and it's really hard to wrap your head around what is driving this uptick here in Southern California.
Yes, the numbers are astounding and they are frightening. And I think it's a number of things that all have come together at the same time. So certainly the numbers in the hospitals that we're seeing today are as a result of some of the transmission that happened around the Thanksgiving holiday. Even before and after Thanksgiving, we all know that there was an increase in the amount of even just casual interactions that people were having. And we've all heard some stories about how that's taken place. We also believe that as the weather gets colder, and as the humidity changes, that allows the virus to spread a little bit more easily as well. And I think what people should remember is that as more and more people are infected, and right now we're projecting that up to about one in every 80 people are infectious and not properly isolated and actively infecting others. When that many people are infectious, the kinds of activities that were safe during the summer or that were safe in the early fall right now are just not safe. The chance of being exposed to someone with the virus is incredibly high. And it's important to also remember that most people who are transmitting the virus don't have symptoms. So you can't tell when you're interacting with someone whether or not they're safe or not safe to interact with. But all of those interactions compound, and they've really built up to the place we're at today.
Doctor, it is really hard to imagine this getting any worse. Are we seeing the height of the surge right now? When do you expect the numbers to go down?
I wish I could say yes to that question, but sadly I can't. What we're seeing is still an escalation in the number of cases. We have not seen the rate of that increase slow to the point that it would make us believe that we're at the peak. I hope that we'll get there in the next few days. I hope that people take the public health guidance seriously. I hope people stay home as much as they can. But I don't think that we're at the point yet in the hospitals where we're going to be seeing a slowing of the cases.
That's Dr. Christina Galli, Los Angeles County Director of the Department of Health Services. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
The coronavirus is running rampant in the UK. Today in England, London joined the cities of Birmingham and Manchester in imposing the highest level of COVID-19 restrictions, Tier 3. Despite the surge in cases, the UK as a whole has been planning to relax restrictions over Christmas. Health officials and others are urging leaders not to ease up. NPR's Frank Langford is in the UK. And Frank, first, how tight are the tightest restrictions there now? How are people being affected?
Well, they're definitely considerably tighter. Pubs and restaurants are only going to be able to serve takeout and delivery. Different households can only mix outdoor in a public place. But stores are remaining open, and we have to believe, Lisa, that that's because of Christmas shopping and keeping the economy going as best the government can.
Yeah, so it's kind of hard to imagine pubs and restaurants being closed essentially around Christmas time when everybody wants to celebrate. And in fact, they are talking in the country about loosening restrictions around Christmas time. What's the rationale for that?
Well, clearly, Lisa, you know, people want to see family, and I think Boris Johnson is being responsive to that. But there is a lot of concern that it's just going to spread the virus even more. And people have been in long, you know, this has been a long, long time under the pandemic, as it has been for other people in the United States. And what you've heard from Johnson, though, it's really interesting, is he's also at the same time saying, you know, people need to think very carefully about their Christmas plans, that there should be a smaller and safer Christmas. So he seems to be sending two different kind of messages. Another thing also is the economy. You know, pubs are very concerned about the impact. My daughter is working at a pub right now as we speak, and they're concerned about getting shut down. We're just outside of London. And then theaters reopened recently and again have had to shut down. So it's been really tough economically on people here.
Well, another sector that's terribly concerned are health officials. What are they
saying? Well, they're not crazy about the idea of loosening things around Christmas and allowing people to meet a bit more. The British Medical Journal actually said that they saw this as a rash decision and they didn't want to see it happen. People, I think, are also ordinary people are concerned about the spread of the virus. I don't know what's going to happen in my neighborhood. There was talk of people getting together, but I think there's a lot of anxiety. Certainly, I'll be honest, I feel it. And there's a woman named Jane Pace from Oxfordshire, and she's with the National Health Service worker. She was talking to the BBC earlier this week, and this is what she had to say.
West buying a home on our own, and none of the family is coming to us at all. We decided it just was not safe. There's too many risks out there, and I couldn't live with myself if I handed COVID on to anybody else.
Frank, as you know, here in the United States, the vaccine is only now being rolled out, the coronavirus vaccine. It has been already issued in the UK. How's it going there?
It's moving along. We just saw this morning from the government, more than 130,000 people have gotten the first doses of this. It's a two-dose vaccine that's gone to the elderly and the vulnerable so far. Those numbers don't include community clinics, which started on Monday, and about 200 such clinics are expected to be up and running by the end of this week. Of course, there are nearly 76 million people in this country. Not everyone, of course, is going to get it, but this vaccination process, it's great that it's happening, but I think people need to be patient, and it's going to take a long time to get to a large part of the population.
Just want to ask one quick question, Frank, about a major issue that's not quick explaining at all, and that is amid the pandemic, there is also Brexit and a December 31st deadline for the UK and the European Union to get the new trade deal established. Where does that stand?
Astonishingly, Lisa, they still haven't gotten a deal yet. They're continuing to negotiate with very little time left. And the concern is if there's no deal, you're going to see major disruption at the ports. This, of course, happening when the economies in Europe and here are not in good shape at all, just as we've been discussing. So I think many people would love to see some kind of deal just to not put this one more blow to the EU and also the United Kingdom.
NPR's Frank Langfitt. Thank you, Frank.
Great to talk to you.
There was a tweet a few years ago by writer Sarah Hoggy that spawned a slew of memes, T-shirts, and tote bags. It reads, "Carry yourself with the confidence of a mediocre white man." Writer Ijeoma Oluo says, "It's more than a pithy line about mediocre individuals given unlimited power, and instead a system we all play a part in." Oluo writes about this in her new book, Mediocre, A Legacy of White Male America. And she joins me now from Seattle, Washington. Hey, Ijeoma.
Hi.
This new book takes us through history and shows us how white supremacy, and more specifically white male mediocrity, has become the core ideology of this country. What do you mean by white male mediocrity? It's not the individual so much as a system that we are all complicit, you say. How do we begin to define it?
I think that, you know, where I define it is really in this idea that white men deserve political power and wealth and safety and security just because they're white men. The idea that they will be seen as the strongest, the best leaders, the most successful, that they will always do better than women and people of color in our society has to be protected regardless of whether or not the white men in question actually have the skills or talent or accomplishments to back up said power or achievements. And so what it does is it's a system that protects mediocrity, that sets that as the goal. And the idea that anything would ask for more of our systems, let alone the people within these systems, becomes a threat to the status quo and to our systems of power.
Would you say this is just an extension of or part of capitalism?
Absolutely. I would say it's not even necessarily an extension of capitalism. It's one of capitalism's main protections. It's how capitalism gets people to sign on repeatedly. It's this idea that your payout is coming. So it may not be readily apparent in your financial status. It may not be, you know, readily apparent in, you know, what percentage of income you're taking home versus what you're creating for businesses. But you will at least look in the mirror and feel better than women or people of color. And it's what gets people signed on, saying, of course you're going to have greatness. It's coming. But it also is a great deflection for why that paycheck never comes. That, you know, oh, well, if you're not getting it, you were supposed to. So someone must have taken it from you. Let's look at these women. Let's look at these people of color who are suddenly getting more, and they must have taken what's yours.
Okay, flipping that a little bit, I have to ask you something that I've been thinking about, which is, who has the right to be mediocre and not just survive, but thrive? Is mediocrity divorced from whiteness what we're striving for? I mean, basically the alternative being that we expect women and women of color more specifically to be exceptional at all times.
You know, I think that's a really great question. And I would say there are two things we're looking at. One, I absolutely believe that every human being, regardless of skill or talent, deserves to have a roof over their head, deserves to feel safe and secure in society. And I don't think that talent or power or prestige or race or gender should dictate, you know, whether or not you get to survive in this country or feel safe in this country. But who leads us and who we reward for their contributions should actually be making meaningful contributions that improve the lives of people in our society, should be leaders that can effectively lead and bring prosperity to everyone, regardless of race and gender or skill or talent. You know, and that's something, you know, that's where I think the difference is. There are fundamental human rights that all of us absolutely deserve that shouldn't have to be earned. And then there's also who leads us to being able to achieve that. And it should be people who've shown that they can effectively lead.
In your book, you select key moments to show how this system works, from the way women were kicked out of the workforce after the Great Depression, to the way that women of color in politics are challenged for holding views on equity in ways their white male colleagues are not. How do you go about choosing what to focus on?
Yeah, you know, I could have written 100 books, right, on this topic and had so much to focus on. And it really, you know, started first with asking, for me, fundamental questions about white male identity in America as a political and social construct, right, through time. And collecting stories and looking through all of, you know, hundreds and hundreds of articles and books and saying, where am I seeing common threads? Where am I seeing something that illustrates, you know, one of the fallacies of these sort of ideals in our society? And what does that look like through time? And so a lot of it was pulling these threads and looking at one story and going, gosh, you know, I can see how this directly ties into this earlier manifestation or this later manifestation of it. So it really, you know, I surprised myself a lot by the things that I ended up including in the book, because it really was, you know, information that was new to me or information I didn't realize was connected till I was diving in.
How do you go about introducing intersectionality, or at least the ways in which this ideology can create fraught relationships between, say, white women and women of color?
One thing that was really clear to me in this book was that you cannot separate race and gender, right, in America, that the power structures that uphold our systems, those two are linked. White supremacy and patriarchy are linked. But what that means then is often when it comes to people who are impacted by maybe one part of white supremacist patriarchy, they'll make deals with it. And so in looking at intersectionality, it's important to recognize that there are segments of the population, segments of what white women in this country who've decided that they're best chance at power is their proximity to white men and upholding white male power, even if it means they will never achieve true liberation. And so we have to look at, you know, in intersectionality, the different ways in which we've made these deals, whether, you know, these are deals because we align ourselves with white men, because we are married to white men, because we've given birth to white men, or because we've decided that we should emulate white men. And who can and who cannot do that have set up different layers of oppression that can often still be baked into our fight for freedom when we don't realize that we're in many ways still hoping to hold on to our proximity to power, even if it is tied to someone else's oppression, while saying we're fighting oppression. So it is really vital when looking at this that we always kind of come back to who's the most impacted by these systems. Because in that, in trying to align ourselves with people who are most impacted, we're going to also confront the ways in which we have been invested in the oppression of others as well and have been upholding these systems. There's no way any of us get true liberation while holding on to our proximity to oppressive power.
You note that white male mediocrity is also killing white men, that we need a new vision for white masculinity. What does that look like, and who is responsible for that vision to take hold?
You know, I don't know what it will look like, because that will absolutely, at the end of the day, be up to white men and up to the people who raise white men and invest in white manhood, right? So we need to look at this and say, this isn't working. It is absolutely harming white men as well. Yes, the extreme brunt of it has fallen on women, non-male populations, and people of color for generations. But 70% of suicides right now are white men. Right. There was something desperately wrong. And we have to figure out what, because it is impacting all of us. But if you care about white men, if you are a white man, if you love white men, you have to start thinking, what is a healthier way to define success in this society? Because there is something incredibly toxic about not knowing how to feel about yourself until you know how you compare to other people. And that's how we have set up our definitions of success in white male society. It is not your own individual talents. It is not your contributions to society. It's, are you doing better at the end of the day than women or people of color? And that's no way to live. That's no way to think about yourself. There is no self-love in that.
Those suicide rates are astounding. But to that end, what incentive that those who benefit from this ideology and power structure, which, as you note, are not just white men, but also white women and people of color. How do we divest without losing it all? And what incentive is there when, as you show, white male mediocrity is so effective at reproducing itself?
You know, one thing that we are suffering from is a collective lack of imagination. We have been so brainwashed into thinking this is the absolute best we can accomplish. I mean, how many times do you hear someone saying, yeah, this system sucks, but it's the best we've got? Why? Why is this the best we've got? We created this system. We can create something new. But what we have is faith in each other and faith in our own, you know, capabilities to create better. And that means looking at the better that's being created and valuing it. It's important to recognize that, you know, there are communities of color right now who have always had to come up with ways to survive and even thrive outside of our systems. Value that and look at that and say, we can create things, right? Look at even in white manhood itself, groups of white men who have said, this is not for me. And they've taken on these extreme battles and found truer versions of themselves. We need to look at that and value it. But that means we have to look at all of the ways in which we have been conditioned to think, you know, that these are limits placed on us, that this is all we can do, and divorce ourselves from it. What I argue is the path that we're on right now, we have very little to lose by trying something new and better, by having faith in each other. We created this system, and it's just one of many, and we can create so many more.
That's Ijeoma Oluo talking about her brand new book, Mediocre, A Legacy of White Male America. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much.
Support for this podcast comes from the Boston Foundation. A resilient city and region relies on the Boston Foundation to bring people together to solve Greater Boston's most serious problems, from the hardships of COVID to the fight for racial equity and other important issues that affect the lives of everyone in our community. Learn how you can help build a Greater Boston that works for everyone by partnering with the Boston Foundation at tbf.org/partner.
President-elect Joe Biden is nominating former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg to serve as his transportation secretary. Buttigieg is a Navy veteran. He's a Rhodes Scholar and was Biden's rival in the Democratic presidential campaign. He dropped out and ultimately endorsed Biden. Here and now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan joins us. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Lisa.
If Buttigieg is confirmed, he will be the first openly gay cabinet member and one of the youngest members of the cabinet in history. But he has never worked in Washington, and the highest office he's served is Mayor Pete. What experience does he have that could help him lead the Department of Transportation?
Well, you're right. This is a 38-year-old man who is, of course, extraordinarily accomplished in many regards, but doesn't have the kind of resume, let's say, that the current Secretary of Transportation, Elaine Chao, had going into it. In her case, she had worked within the Department of Transportation in the past, but running South Bend, he's somebody who's taken an interest, for example, in what they call a smart streets initiative there, sort of integrating road planning that works well with transit, emphasizing that kind of growth, transit-oriented growth over sort of the typical suburban automotive-oriented growth that has dominated the United States for much of the past half century.
And he could be a key figure in the administration if he gets confirmed, because Biden has an ambitious plan to repair the country's infrastructure. I wonder if you could describe that plan and tell us what it would require of Buttigieg.
Right. Billions of dollars, kind of integrating transportation planning with clean energy, a lot of that. So prioritizing high-speed rail and that sort of thing. In the short term here, transit systems, of course, are looking for help from Washington to get out of the hole that they're in related to the pandemic. So you've got short-term plans and then those longer-term visions that Joe Biden has to really change the way Americans get around again, de-emphasizing sort of single-use automobiles and emphasizing other kinds of transportation, but also clean cars and electric power cars and that sort of thing.
Okay, so he would be front and center if that happens. We should say that President Trump also pledged to rebuild the country's crumbling roads and bridges, a really serious problem, but never made good on that promise. Joe Biden is going to need support from Congress to implement his plans. How likely is it that he'll get it?
Well, it'll depend a lot on what happens in Georgia next month, right? Those two Senate races. Is there going to be the slimmest of Democratic majorities if Democrats manage to get both of those seats and then Kamala Harris serves as the tie-breaking vote in favor of Democrats or not? Because the answer to that question obviously is going to determine a lot else. And, as you said, not a lot has happened considering the ambitions 4 years ago in the past few years and not a lot of signs of gridlock breaking anytime soon in Washington.
And just very briefly, how partisan an issue is transportation? I mean, if both President Trump and Joe Biden think it needs to get done, briefly.
Well, it's the kind of transportation. It's the details, right? Donald Trump thinks more in terms of roads and bridges. Somebody like Joe Biden, as everybody knows, a big Amtrak user, thinks more in terms of public transportation, that kind of project.
Okay. Transportation analyst Seth Kaplan, thank you.
Thank you, Lisa.
Well, the days of waiting in long lines for COVID tests could be over soon. Allume, an Australian company, is the first to get its at-home over-the-counter COVID test emergency authorization from the FDA this week. The do-it-yourself test will cost about $30 and is expected to be available in limited quantities starting next month. For more, let's bring in Eric Paraxilis. He's a faculty member at Duke University. And Eric, we had you on the show before to talk about how the U.S. was lagging behind other countries in terms of testing ability. How big of a deal is this test? And is it actually significant that an Australian company is the first to get their FDA authorized for emergency use?
I think it's a big deal. I think the future of medicine is going to be more convenient, more local, and more affordable. And, it was an Australian company that did this, but they did have a $30 million grant from the United States National Institutes of Health. So I think they were selected as the best company, regardless of where they were.
Got it. Let's talk about the test itself. There have been some home tests developed, but these required you actually send your sample to a lab. This one doesn't. You just have to download an app on your phone. Can you explain how this technology works?
Yeah, so basically what happens is you buy a kit, and the kit has the test device, the sample device, and, Bluetooth, the device itself connects to your phone by Bluetooth. I'm sure you download an app, and you collect a mid-nasal sample. And basically, the app itself also plays a video that walks the user through all the steps of collecting the sample, performing the test. It displays the results. It computes the results, and then it actually transmits the results once that is done.
Okay, transmits the results, and then how accurate are these results?
In the initial data provided to the FDA, the test correctly identified 96% of positive samples and 100% of negative samples in individuals with symptoms. Without symptoms, it correctly identified 91% of positive samples and 96% of negative samples. So very accurate at this point.
Do you also have any concerns that at-home tests like these could actually lure us into a false sense of security, everyone taking one then going to a large gathering, for instance?
Absolutely. I think that's exactly the concern that we have to have. You can picture everybody getting one of these and then taking them and then going to their large holiday gathering, like you say, right? We don't know exactly how long after somebody is expressing antigen or antibody that they're going to be contagious to people around them. So even if you have your test status, this is one of the reasons why, the quarantine periods that are recommended are in place. So if you take that same scenario and this large group of people in this neighborhood all transmit these negative results, somebody could be looking at the map and saying, oh, look, there's not much COVID in that neighborhood, which could be wrong, right? So I think we have to be careful of how the test is used and how the data is used.
So who should use one of these tests once they come on the market next month?
For me, it would be a low-risk person with mild or moderate symptoms or a high-risk person with minor symptoms. Testing is still most useful in the context of symptoms. And I think, you know, if you have flu symptoms or you're home and you're wondering if you have COVID and you're not high risk, this is a great way to save yourself a trip to the doctor and figure things out. If you're very sick or moderately sick and you're high risk, you should go seek care. And so I think those types of use cases might be the sweet spot for this test. But I think that has to be determined and communicated by health authorities.
You touched on this before, but do you think this technology is going to change the way other medical tests are done, being able to do it from the comfort of your home and then sharing your results in the cloud?
I think so. I think, you know, one of the good technology stories of COVID has been telehealth. And, you know, I've done telehealth visits, and I think they're great. It's wonderful to not have to go and just get on the screen for 15 minutes. The one thing we don't want to lose is the expert determination, right? You know, you get a test result, and you still have to make decisions. I think we still have to have the best type of guidance for those decisions.
Eric Paraxilis is a faculty member at Duke University. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Well, advances in home testing and vaccines may soon help to protect our family and friends. For hundreds of thousands of Americans, this will mark their first Christmas or New Year's without a loved one. And mourning, like celebrations, is full of rituals, saying goodbye, grieving as family or community, and marking a series of firsts. As WHYY's Hemina Condi reports, the pandemic is changing how people grieve.
During the last months of each year, Ida Robinson was focused on one thing.
First of November, my mother would go shopping for straight through to New Year's.
That's Ida's daughter, Joanne Robinson.
You know, she would even go down south and get her black walnuts. She gathered rum so she can do her fruitcakes because they would have to soak for 8 weeks. And, you know, just little things like that.
Ida died this past April at the age of 84 from coronavirus complications. Joanne didn't get to say a final goodbye to her mother in the hospital. And she says perhaps it was for the best.
At the last few moments, she was taken off for everything and just was laying in a bed with just her face showing. And, you know, she was sedated. She didn't know anyone was in the room. She couldn't move, couldn't talk, couldn't open her eyes or anything.
Even if Ida had been awake, Joanne says it's unlikely she would have recognized the relatives who were at her bedside. They were covered head to toe in PPE.
I didn't want that to be our last memories. We have far more better memories than that.
Every now and then, Joanne will play some of the final voicemails Ida left on the answering machine before getting sick. Ida was in her long-term care facility at the time and checking in.
Talk to you later. This is Ida Robinson. Okay. Bye-bye. Oh, this is Ida. Just wondering how y'all was doing.
Joanne tears up every time she hears the messages, but she also finds some sort of comfort. With the winter holidays coming up, Joanne is trying to find ways to stay upbeat while still feeling close to her mother, who she used to see every week. Still, grieving, like so many things during the pandemic, looks different this year. Joanne's daughter, Diamond Franklin, says she and her mom can't lean on family or church the way they typically would in trying times.
During a time of grief, you usually seek to come together more. Mm-hmm. You seek that and to embrace one another. And it's difficult going through the loss of a loved one at a time where everyone is unfortunately forced to be apart.
Kathleen O'Hara is a psychotherapist who helps mourning families across the globe grieve.
This is grief on steroids.
She says the grief brought about by COVID-19 is different from other grief.
There is fear around the disease itself, how it could have happened. There's the fear of the unknown. There's also the quickness of it, no warning, things like that. So it's grief, but there's a trauma component to it.
O'Hara is no stranger to traumatic grief herself. Her son Aaron was murdered in 1999 when he was 20 years old. But she says that even when faced with extreme hardship and unbearable grief, human beings are resilient. O'Hara says people can't change how the pandemic barred them from making their final goodbyes or going to funeral services. But there are other ways to move forward and mourn.
We can tell stories. We can create a video. We can share the good things about their lives. We can laugh. We can cry. We can give thanks.
And even if that sounds all but impossible to grieving families right now, O'Hara has words that might not sound very comforting, but are meant to be.
your grief is real and true, and it has to be gone through. There's no way around it. You know, cry, yell, scream, and then know that this will pass. And create the new rituals that will make your loved one closer to you.
Joanne Robinson's approach to grieving her mother Ida's death has been to remember the positive. Right before Ida's nursing home went on lockdown, Joanne and her daughter Diamond took Ida for a big birthday celebration.
Her birthday was February the 29th. She was a leap year baby, so she actually got a chance to have a birthday on her birthday.
Yes.
And we celebrated with 3 weeks in a row.
And even though the pandemic limits the size of this year's holiday feast, Joanne and her daughter Diamond want to honor Ida's memory by making the food she used to love. They won't be going to Philadelphia's famous Reading Terminal Market to get cured meats or cross state lines to get black walnuts. But Diamond says she will attempt to make Ida's famous pineapple cake with coconut flakes and icing.
I myself am not as skilled a cook as my mother and my grandmother, but I do like to help and just watch and witness, because I feel like I'm almost seeing my grandmother cooking through my mother.
And maybe if Joanne longs for her mother, she might play one of Ida's final messages to the family.
Hello, Joanne. This is your grandma. This is your mom. When you get a chance, give me a call. Okay, bye-bye.
For Here and Now, I'm Ximena Conde.
Keep the shiny new gems. Forgo PlayStation 5. If you want to give a really popular holiday gift, think food. And if you need a little help in your thinking, Here and Now's resident chef Kathy Gunst is just the person to plant some ideas. Hi, Kathy.
Hello, Lisa.
So giving cookies and some other kind of treat is a tradition for many people this time of year. I wonder if you think, though, that that has changed with the pandemic and we'll just have to go with the PlayStation 5.
Well, I think probably, whatever, your 8-year-old's probably not going to appreciate getting cookies instead of their favorite new toy. However, many people have been spending a lot more time in their kitchens during this pandemic, and this is a great time to kind of show off what you've learned. If you've been mastering sourdough, make bread. If you've gotten great at cookies or sauces, to give a gift of food is, it's going to sound like such a cliche, but it is an act of love to create something in your kitchen, wrap it up, and give it to someone that you love. For me, as a cook and a food writer, it is the ultimate gift and the ultimate way to share. And I always include the recipe with the gift so that it can be repeated and carried on.
Ah, that's a great idea. And we should tell people we're going to include the recipes that you're going to talk about on our website here in now.org. So first off, a new shortbread recipe that you want to tell us about.
Yeah, I mean, we tend to go straight to sugar and sweets. And I wanted to try to create something that was cookie-like but savory. So this is a shortbread that's made with sharp cheddar cheese, fresh rosemary, and chili peppers. So it's cheesy and it's crumbly, but it's also got a little bite right at the end from the chili flakes. It's quite easy to make, and the aromatic, woodsy, fresh rosemary just permeates this cookie. And it's equally good with champagne or holiday wine as it is with morning coffee or afternoon tea.
And what if you still crave something sweet to give as a gift? I know there's always sweet shortbread, but what are your other suggestions?
Yes, we do crave sweet things around this time of year. In fact, if you look at pictures on Instagram and social media, it looks like a sugar frenzy. My ritual every year is I make butter crunch, which sounds a lot more complex than it is. You boil sugar and butter and let it caramelize. You let it cool. And then I spread the caramel with dark chocolate and toasted pistachio nuts. And then I sprinkle on some coarse sea salt. And the butter crunch will last for close to 2 weeks. And no one has ever not adored that gift. It is a gift I give year after year. And I never get tired of making it. I also talked several months ago during a piece we did about miso, about a miso caramel sauce. This would be a wonderful gift to give. Again, boiling butter and sugar, but then it gets this umami pow of miso paste. Really different, and it can be used in so many ways. We also will link you to a hot fudge sauce for ice cream that will keep for several weeks. So you can go sweet or savory.
Kathy Gunst, for those who feel as I do that there's no way what comes out of your kitchen is going to be the same as what comes out of my kitchen, where would you go if you want to get a nice gift of food that somebody else makes?
Yes. Well, I know that these are wonderful whether you love to cook or not. There is a wonderful series of condiments from Aurea's Malaysian Kitchen. These are sambals, and in Southeast Asia, sambal is as common as American ketchup. She produces a hot chili sambal with fresh ground chilies and spices and a lime leaf sambal. And then there's also a salted caramel kaya, which is a rich coconut spread that's spread on toast or can be used with pancakes and waffles. Another great choice is a bakery, a virtual bakery. Azaris Bellamy from Blondery makes the most perfect blondie. And her goal in her bakery is, quote, to make a profession that's a better place for women and people of color. And she is producing these moist, rich, perfect bites of pecans and salted caramels on a blondie. And the way she packages these things, it's a wonderful gift.
And how about some boutique olive oils that I've heard you talk about?
Yeah, there's a farm in Northern California, Brightland. The owner comes from a family of salt farmers in South India, and she has created really buttery, just delicious olive oils. There's a basil olive oil, high in antioxidants. They also have a high smoke point, so you can cook with it or drizzle it on your salads. And that's wonderful. There's also some fabulous salt, sea salt, coming out of Duxbury, Mass., a woman-owned company, and fabulous cheeses from Vermont, Jasper Hill Farms. Just creamy, and cheesemakers have been hit really hard this year. Also, restaurant gift certificates. Restaurants are struggling so much. Buy someone a certificate, help the restaurant and a friend.
And we will have all of Kathy Gunst's suggestions and her recipe for cheddar cheese, rosemary, and chili shortbread at hereandnow.org. Kathy, thank you, and happy holidays.
Happy holidays, Lisa. Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.